I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, we look at the world of work with Joanna Biggs, and all day long, a portrait of Britain at work. And then Stephen Alcock talks about his debut novel, Blood Relatives. Joanna Biggs is an editor at the London Review of Books. She has written for The New Yorker, The Guardian and The Sunday Times, and she's now the author of All Day Long, A Portrait of Britain at Work. So, Joanna, thank you very much for coming in to talk to me.
Oh, no, thank you for having me.
Tell me what the idea behind this book is.
Well, one thing about work is that we do it all day, every day, mm-hmm. our whole lives, 100,000 hours, whatever it is, but we don't tend to think about it. It's one of those things where we have a drink at the end of the day to forget it. I remember as a child not really knowing what my father did and trying mm-hmm. to ask him and having no notion. I think of things like, you see that in the children's book, like The Time It Comes to Tea, the father who has just sinister father who comes home and they're all scared of him and no one knows what he does all day. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to look at our everyday lives in a different way and just set down what work was on some level. So each portrait of a person's day has just, you know, how they get to work mm-hmm. and how much coffee they have, so go very small details. But also, the timing of it was trying to think about what happened to the country since 2008, the 2008 financial crash. Mm-hmm. Came out just the month before the election and trying to say, look, this is what's happening across the country, this is what people's lives are like, this is how they feel, this is what they feel has happened to them since mm-hmm. 2008. So that was part of it too.
And the world of work itself has changed. It's unrecognisable from what that fictional father's job would have been.
Yeah, the 1950s.
Yeah. In fact, before we talk about how the world of work has changed, there's always been this idea that, well, just work itself, employment in that sort of way, would be done away with. That there would be this future where nobody was sort of working. And while a lot of industries are unrecognisable from that time, there's absolutely no danger of work being done away with so far, is there?
No, you're referring to the Keynes, the great Keynes, mm-hmm. say, possibly for our grandchildren. Exactly, he says 3 hours a day, we'd all be working 3 hours a day. And, of course, we haven't got there. I started to worry. I spoke to a lot of people who said how much they loved their jobs. Mm-hmm. And that started to worry me because it felt like just as certain sorts of work were becoming obsolete and it was how Keynes saw things was possible, mm-hmm. people were clinging on to jobs, clinging on to work for their identity, and even, you know, they said they love it and you talk to them a bit more and you realise they didn't quite, but they felt like they had to say that, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I don't quite know what's going on there. It's sort of both a paradox and some anxiety that we haven't quite worked through as a society or something, I don't know.
But also, I mean, we'll talk more closely about that later on, but there are certain aspect areas of work that you talk about in this book where you're forced to love it, right? Yeah, it's like almost a rule that if you don't demonstrate that you love your job, that's a bad thing.
Yeah, exactly. So this is this trend towards effective labour, emotional labour. I just spoke to some baristas who work at Pratt, and part of the Pratt code, the way they've part of the recruitment process, the whole thing is trying to make anyone who comes in to their stores just, you know, you just bang a sandwich, you're just getting a coffee, it's fine if that's a fairly mm-hmm. transactional thing. But they're supposed to ask you about your weekend, make you feel good, make you go away. This new thing that's come out that they can give you a free coffee depending on how they feel, mm-hmm. how they've judged your friendliness or even your sadness, I guess, and they're trying to cheer you up with a coffee. So there's all these things that sort of, as the jobs that are making things or disappearing, be taken over by, I think, robots mm-hmm. and machines, that the jobs that are left to have more have to be these sort of jobs that we love and jobs that we enact, you know, use our emotions for, not just our, you know, hands and strength.
Behaviours, prep behaviours, that they're called in that way, which no doubt sounded fine to whoever came up with that idea of prep, but it just sounds so sinister to me.
No, it does. And it's sort of robotic. Like, there was a great bit where I spoke to one of the baristas and he would say he found it really hard. He'd come from the Czech Republic where you didn't have that kind of chit-chat, sort of American-style chit-chat at each transaction. And he'd say he would watch a colleague who was just naturally sunny, could do it, and she would say, you know, why don't you just say, you know, have a nice weekend? And so you say, okay, now have a nice weekend. And obviously Monday you say it, Tuesday you say it, Wednesday, gets to Thursday. The weekend's very far away at that point. And he was still saying he just didn't quite know how to kind of do that. And why should he? You know, that's not all one brings to a job.
You start the book off in a charity shop in Dover, which is your hometown. Those people are, they're not even working for money.
No, exactly. And one of the things I was thinking about entirely, well, throughout the 2 years of writing the book, I often thought about what work, what was the motivations for work. So lots of people told me they wouldn't work for money. Lots of people wanted to feel that what they did all day contributed to the world in some way, some small way. So making one person's life better, or, you know, making their children's life better, or just little things like that. They wouldn't feel that they... Because work is more than that, isn't it? Is it just what we earn? It's how we it is how we think about ourselves. It is how we want to account for our lives on our deathbed, slightly. What did we do? What did we make? What did we contribute to the world?
But also it demonstrates, again, that idea that, I mean, there are certain things that we'll definitely touch on in this interview, that it's debatable whether they're classed as work, or people want to categorise them as work and other people don't. And then you get this sort of situation where people are doing something which is definitely work, turning up, working for somebody else for a set amount of hours a day, but that key element that is the reason why we all work is the one thing that's missing.
Money, you mean?
Yeah.
And you think we always work for money?
Well, I mean, that seems to be the reason why people have to work. I mean, certainly if we can be in the position where we can work out of love because we have the leisure time to do so or the ability to do so.
Yeah.
But it seems odd to be working for... Well, first of all, let me try and rephrase this. Not just working, because obviously a lot of the people there are volunteering, which is a different thing. I mean, it's obviously work, but they're volunteering. But also, there were people working there that didn't want to be necessarily working there, but were being sort of punitively...
Oh, so
work there. Yes.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things about starting with that situation is you're taking away the money completely. So you're seeing people who come just to hang out with friends, literally come out, hang out with friends and make cups of tea and share bags of sweets and chat. People who feel like they get more out of that than their normal paid wage job, that they feel like they're doing something, contributing to something, a charity. And then people who, have to be there because they've got a speeding fine, they've got community service, or they've gone the government's welfare programme. That seemed to me quite stark, and some things that were sort of happening to the world at work, that on some level you have these people loving it, some people who you see it have these wonderful kind of experiences at work, you know, like kind of Google and people going on bouncy chairs and ripsticks and all that exciting stuff. And on the other end, you've got people who are just being forced into doing things that don't seem to have any value for them in particular, but also perhaps society. And in the end of the last chapter of the book is another person, who did work for, and he was just spending time breaking up furniture, and that doesn't seem like how can you use that generally for the next, you know, say to your employer, I spent 6 weeks breaking up furniture and that's going to get you a job, it's not going to get any
unless it's another breaking up furniture
place. I mean, it's like breaking up stones in, you know, Robben Island. I mean, it's just so anyway.
I want to, before we get into going through some of the book is broken up into chapters that look at various different, I guess, themes of work, shall we say. And before we do that, I want to take a couple of examples from there, but at the sort of the bottom and the top end of the spectrum. And there's a company director that you talk to. It's a woman, and she's had a very interesting career, and seems like quite atypical, even for the very small group, the very particularly tiny group of company directors that there are. But I wonder, I mean, to what extent the people at that end know, understand and can recognise what the world of work is like for people right at the far end.
Well, one thing they both have in common is just this extreme hours they both work, actually, weirdly. That you think of someone working three jobs would have the same experience as someone right at the top who who has to have her breakfast put underneath her nose before she'll eat it. That's the one thing that she would say. She gets up early, gets in before her PA, and spends most of her evenings, weekday evenings that is, either on functions or kind of. And also, you know, like, talking about emotional labour, we talked about prep, but also she has to show up to these kind of dinners, which I imagine aren't always that thrilling, even if, you know, they're catered and champagne and all that. But, and maybe she doesn't want to be there, maybe she wants to be with her husband and her children, who she would talk a lot about in the interview. So there is those sort of things too. So there is a kind of, there's extremes of truth, you know, the top and the bottom kind of have a lot in common. But yeah, I don't, I'm not sure that she would really know what it's like to live a normal life, no. She understood that she had employees, but I don't think she would necessarily know exactly what their lives were like.
Mm-hmm.
She might dispute that if she was here, but I didn't get the sense, personally, that she really knew what it was like.
Let's go right back down to, I don't even want to talk about work, I want to talk about unemployment, I guess. So what is the situation currently in terms of, you know, we talked about workfare briefly, how difficult is it for people that are out of work to basically get back into the world of work?
The peculiar thing about being unemployed at the moment is the way that it's, well, the first thing to say is that you don't get very much money at all.
Yeah.
£70 a week, which is nothing. But the second thing is the way the kind of regime is imagined is that you have to, so the first week you have to apply for, previously apply for one job or two jobs on this. And it gradually goes up week by week by week, and you have to apply for jobs that you know you don't want or can't get, but you have to prove that you've applied for so many jobs before you can get your money. You have to apply for this computer, this universal job matching computer, doesn't always work, picks up the wrong things for you. It doesn't really matter what you want to do. And I think, I don't know the figures off the top of my head, but there is a sense that people don't really get jobs in the job centre anymore. It's not like, you know, the 1950s Apex Exchange, you'd go there and say, I'm a welder, what else have you got? I've just been put out of work, what else have you got? And you get a job at the end of the week. It's just not like that. I mean, it is a bad situation, and all the responsibility seems to be on the person trying to find work. There's no sense that there might not be enough jobs, that we might not have the right skills, that we might be in a recession. You know, all those things don't seem to be acknowledged by the government, and certainly not by the job centre.
And also that the emphasis on having to find any job, you need to be in work, you need to find a job, also prevents, it seems to prevent people from being able to pursue the job that they would want.
Yeah, and that's exactly the case with Kate Riley, that famous workfare case, that she was just young, graduated from university, had a part-time position in a museum, I think, and was told by the job centre that she couldn't do that, she had to go to Canada to stack shelves, and you know, she was vilified for complaining and saying, why do I have to do this thing to keep benefits, which should be, that should be part of being a citizen of the UK in 2015. And the thing I actually want to do, the thing that I will get me skills, will hopefully for a better job in the future, I'm not allowed to do. So it's exactly that problem. Like, do we want to, it's just this rhetoric, you know, hardworking families, hardworking, feeling like work is the only thing that matters to be a citizen. And I think that seems depressing, doesn't it?
And the workfare, I mean, we talked briefly about it, this idea of, you know, for somebody working in a charity shop, which, you know, the vast majority of the staff there are volunteering, but when you talk about somebody being on workfare, working in Poundland, a business that should be employing people and paying for them,
yes,
then, you know, it becomes even more problematic.
Yeah, of course. And so many, the brilliant campaigns like Boycott Workfare shamed and named so many of these companies, including the charities, and got them to stop doing it, which is wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, it did. It really had an effect.
Yeah, and continue to. And
just one other thing then, at the getting into work level, actually, more than not being able to find work. But I just wanted to spend some time talking about internships.
Yeah.
And obviously, again, it's a sort of course that I have at the moment. The free, you know, working for free for 6 months to get into the jobs that everybody wants to do, which of course means that they're only available to a tiny percent of the people who could potentially do those jobs.
Yeah, and young people are angry about that. And I understand why. It shouldn't be like that. I spent some time with future interns who are really fun and creative. They're based at an art school, and they spend their time doing targeting kind of arts organisations, exactly these kind of like these places with an aura where any girl or boy would want a man or woman, I should say, would want to work. So mm-hmm. this, at the Serpentine, they went dressed up as Santas and said, "All I want for Christmas is pay," on a huge banner, and handed out kind of scrolls to everybody. And I went on with them on an action at the Barbican where they all put on masks of like Bach and Wagner and asked the people who were coming to see the LSO to accept, you know, take this scroll, which explained about a particular. I mean, I remember when I opened it myself, I was quite shocked. It's this huge kind of advert for an intern. It wasn't just to be like an intern if you'd like to apply, but it's, you know, all these qualities you're supposed to have, all these duties you're supposed to have, and at the end it says, "Oh, you might get some free tickets," and for 6 months with no pay. And just, that's not the world any of us want to live in.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly they don't. And I just, the brilliant thing about them is that each time they do one of these things, it's so creative, it's so high profile, that actually they back down. So the Serpentine back down, they now pay interns, so do the LSO, mm-hmm. the London Symphony Orchestra, which is quite right too.
Listening to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Joanna Biggs, and we're talking about her book All Day Long, A Portrait of Britain at Work. And so, Joanna, let's look at some of the Britons at work then in the second part. Actually, they're not all Britons, but then there you go. Manufacturing, that's one of those areas that I sort of mentioned has changed beyond all recognition. And a couple of the people that you talk to, it's interesting because I wonder about the choices, really, because there is still the traditional manufacturing, even though it's like massively reduced. You talk to a shoemaker, a specialist ballet shoemaking company, and potters at Emma Bridgewater Pottery, which is like sort of, you know, posh pottery. Both of those things are they're obviously ancient crafts, but also it's quite a niche thing now, both of those things. Was that a deliberate choice?
I think that's where it's going. Manufacturing. I think quite a lot of mass-produced things have moved all the way to China. Mm-hmm. I couldn't even watch how certain things are made, I don't think, in this country. The third example you haven't said, which maybe we'll be coming onto it a bit later, is I went to a car factory and looked at the way mm-hmm. robots put cars together. And obviously, that was something that used to be heavily unionised, a huge employer,
yeah.
and doesn't really exist anymore.
Indeed, your example was the robot.
Yeah.
As the worker.
Yeah.
He was the worker.
Yeah, which I think that is how, that's
yeah.
the way it's going. And these niche things, yeah, I think that's obviously how Germany has become so wealthy. They're so good at this thing called the Mittelstand, where they some make excellent glass eyes or brilliant kind of crutches. These things that people need to be good quality, they need, they do need constant supply of, but they don't need, you know, and people can afford to spend more money on them because they are so specialist. So I think that this is just one of the ways that manufacturing has changed in the West, certainly.
And what was this, you know, where was everybody supposed to work? I mean, talking about this country in particular, as you said, you know, somewhere like Germany, there's still a huge, proper industrial manufacturing base in the country, which we have gotten rid of over the last 20 or 30 years. And what was everybody supposed to do? What was the idea that everybody would be working in? Because again, it wasn't going to be nobody's going to be working, robots are going to do it. Or we'll all be working 3 hours a day in Keynes' estimation.
But this is like the crisis of capitalism, isn't it? Or the failure of our governments to sort of understand what's been happening to the world of work. And why don't we follow Keynes and try and share it out a bit more equally? Why is the CEO working so many hours she could share her job? Why is the woman at the bottom not even getting, you know, cleaner, having to have 3 jobs and not even getting the London living wage or whatever, or the UK living wage? People don't talk about that as much, but that is also an important thing. I mean, everything is organised badly, basically. And where are the jobs? I completely agree. I don't think there's any vision from any of our political parties about where jobs are supposed to come from and where we're supposed to go with the economy. The March of the Makers from Osborne didn't really mean much. They're just trying to say, let's be like Germany. It didn't really, doesn't really seem to me there is anything that is a coherent vision of how we're supposed to work in the future.
Mm. We need to get into the lucrative glass eye industry. That's what it is.
But we can't, because Germany are. But that's the thing. Like, that's the problem with Germany and Greece. Mm-hmm. Like, Germany think Greece should be like them. That's not possible. Not everyone can be Germany.
You interviewed a Bulgarian, as it happens, sex worker. Two things about it. First, sex work is something that is striving for legitimacy, to be recognised as, well, legitimacy in two ways, to be recognised as actual work, you know, for people to say it is a job, but also it's illegal, so it's, you know, in various different permutations.
The legality is a quite interesting question, because it's not actually paying for sex that's illegal, it's all the activities around it, so soliciting and advertising, so all those things. So it's an interesting legal situation.
Yeah, but there is a legal situation,
is
what I was trying to say. So it's not like, there is that situation which also prevents it from being like a job where one pays taxes and so on and so forth, and national insurance. And again, that's an interesting thing, because it's, I mean, you talk to a stay-at-home mum, I was going to say a housewife, that's a little bit of an old-fashioned description. Again, I mean, it strikes me that, you know, people have fought for years to say that housework is work and it should therefore be recognised as work and perhaps compensated for in a similar way. And so it seems odd that there is this sort of ongoing discussion about sex work.
Well, I think one thing that the English Collective Prostitutes, who the person that I speak to is a member of the Collective Prostitutes, have been going since about the 60s, 70s, is arguing for is the legalisation of it. Mm-hmm. So they would have this legitimate thing. They would be able to call the police if they had problems, as opposed to now, where they obviously can't do that. They have to have look out for each other and have a maid who knows what's going on, and they also have to skirt around the law in certain ways that sometimes makes their job more dangerous. And I think housewives too, they come together in interesting ways. One of the things the ECP and the Wages for Housework movement, these are both 70s movements that grew up together, both arguing that sex work is legitimate work and arguing that housework is legitimate work. I mean, they are, aren't they? Isn't a housewife some sort of sex worker in some way? If you talk about marriage as kind of a legal contract, you just, one man sleeps with one woman, she provides food and comfort and all these things. I mean, it's a quite cynical way of seeing relationships, perhaps, and where does love come into this? But the idea that that women's work has never been entirely understood as work before, and you have to fight and say, no, it is work when you have sex when you don't want to. It is work whether you're a housewife or you're a sex worker. Mm-hmm. It is work when you smile and make a man feel better when you perhaps don't feel better yourself. All that stuff is work, but work that's not recognised in the wage system.
There was only a couple of people that you interviewed in this book that wanted to be paid to talk to you, the sex worker being one of them, which seems entirely reasonable.
And it didn't seem reasonable to you.
Yeah.
It seemed reasonable to me, because I thought it was saying...
Well, you were basically taking up a block of her time, and that is what she charges for, ultimately. Whatever it is she was doing, she is basically, somebody is giving her some money to spend a period of time with her to do whatever.
Why I liked that she asked me and why I paid her and why I thought it was okay was because I thought she made... I think it is work talking to somebody. I think it is work to try and to reveal things about your life and think about them. You know, 2 hours, I was exhausted after some of these interviews, and I bet they were too. Mm. So what I liked about it is it made visible a work that doesn't seem like work, which is the point I was trying to make with kind of house, you know, with stay-at-home mothers and with other people who don't earn money through their work. So I like that. I like that she asked me, but I can see that other people might not think that was the right, you know.
Well, the other person right at the far end of the spectrum that asked to be paid, I don't even know if it was that the actual person you ended up interviewing that asked to be paid, was it?
No, someone else I approached. I couldn't have afforded the fee suggested.
Yeah, so the other person that you didn't end up interviewing then, who did ask to be paid, was a professional footballer. Mm. And we do interview a different professional footballer who, we should say, didn't ask to be paid. It's probably an important thing to say. Which, I don't know, you know, without making some sort of glib connection between sex workers and footballers, seems like also not surprising in some sort of way. It's the mercenary way that the game has gone in this sort of way. It seems like, not even necessarily that that particular footballer was particularly venal or something. It's just that, again, the game has gone in the direction, or could be professional sports has gone in that direction, where everything involved in it has a dollar value. Everybody wants to be paid for everything, and everybody's taking a cut out of it. So again, it seems like not surprising.
Another thing that's interesting is that they both knew their market values. So, the sex worker asked for £50 for a half hour, which is how much she would charge a client for, I think, for full sex, pretty much. And so that's saying, this is how much I know my time costs. And he asked for £5,000 for just an interview. And I think it's both them saying, we know that we are in a market, this is how much we know.
And that somebody else would pay it.
Yeah, someone else would pay it. And also that it's a short, both of those are short careers.
Yeah. So
you can't be, I mean, perhaps you can be separate, but you can't be a footballer forever. And, you know, there's a kind of melancholy recognition when I talk to the sex worker that she knows that on her first day she earned a huge amount of money because she was new, she was a novelty, and as time has gone on that's reduced, and so there will become a point where it's not worth her time. She's, at the moment she's 19, I think, or 21, now she's going to know that.
21.
But at the moment she's 21, and she knows that as time goes on she won't be able to earn as much money. So there's a sort of recognition that there's a limited time in which I can ask this, so I'm going to ask it, you know? And that's okay, I think, maybe.
There's a section of the book entitled Thinking, you interview a scientist, and also Marina Warner, professor. And I really wanted to talk in, not about them in particular, but just about, you illustrate through both of those chapters, I think, this sort of changing face of academia, how things are, you know, where things are going. And I wanted to talk about that, and I guess those are places where the next generation of workers are going to come from. And universities are becoming more and more a place to incubate the next generation of workers rather than the next generation of thinkers.
Yeah, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to Marina Warner is because she has made vital contributions to this discussion that we're having about our universities and what they're for. And she left the University of Essex because they tightened the way that she, her kind of work remit to such a degree that it wasn't possible for her to do things that, you know, the things that she needs to do as a writer and thinker to be able to do, to write the books that she's written. You know, she's just won the Holberg Prize, a huge amount of money. I mean, she's the chair of the Man Book International. She's one of our, she's a really important thinker for generations of students. And for me myself, I really admire her work. But she was trying to say that these things, in tightening it so much for the students and for the teachers, you're creating a sort of transactional and kind of small-minded view of what the intellectual life is like, and also what work is like, I guess.
In the section, there's a section on caring, care workers and cleaners, both of whom do, I mean, again, these are jobs that I think when people talk about the end of work, the idea that nobody will have to work, and these are jobs that are never going away. Like, we need people to look after other people.
Yeah.
These are both jobs that are incredibly undervalued by society, badly paid, most likely to be on zero-hour contracts and stuff. And again, this is not, it just seems that gets worse for the people in that situation rather than better. Why are they so undervalued?
I don't understand that, to be honest, either, really. I guess because it's traditionally women's work, women's work hasn't been paid and has been undervalued. I think, well, the story, for example, for home care workers is to do with the failure post-1945 to set up a sort of NHS for care work, which periodically we talk about, periodically we realise isn't possible. Which is depressing in itself. Why can't we do this sort of thing in a rich society, in a peaceful Europe for over very many years? And so it's always been parcelled out in kind of between charities and local authorities. And, you know, in local authorities, they put like, put up a tender, and then obviously the person with the lowest, who has the lowest fee, wins. And then it's the, you know, they rely on people with amazing hearts and time and to pick up the pieces when these things don't go right, and that's generally what happens. The person I spoke to, Rochelle Monte, she's now sort of become a campaigner for better, against zero-hours contracts, against things like not getting paid for the travel time between appointments, and she has had a huge effect. She's angry and eloquent, and she's lived it. She lives it every day. She still works as a care worker. And she's sort of a heroine. you know, like she cried telling me about some of her people that she worked for and become friends with. She's the person who gets as angry as a family member when someone with dementia is just left, you know, left without food, left in his own kind of excrement because no one has been there to help him get to the toilet and help him get ready in the morning. I mean, she's amazing, and I don't understand why it's not undervalued. I couldn't do it.
Just to finish off, you end up at the end of the book going back to your old junior school briefly. So I just wanted to talk about what's the future of work going to be like? Big question, perhaps. So, you know, what's the future of work going to be like for those children? What's it going to be like when they eventually out there looking for work?
I don't really believe in predicting the future, but I did read a couple of jobs reports which had very depressing job descriptions, like climate change specialist.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
There's a couple of them in the book, and I thought the world is going to be, it's going to be a dystopian nightmare. And the children I spoke to were so charming. They wanted to be vets, or they wanted to be a dancer. They wanted to be, so many of them wanted to be footballers, or they wanted to be a teacher, or they had these, they saw, it was like, I really like animals, so I want to be with animals all day, every day.
Yeah.
I really like my friends, so I want to be with my friends playing football all day, every day. I really like drawing, so I just want to draw all day. And there's something rather wonderful about that optimism, and then when it contrasts with this idea that the planet will be warmed by 6 degrees and it will be unrecognisable, and inequality will have worsened to a depressing point. And
the global warming specialist, that's quite a specialised job. I think most people are going to be employed in building seawalls and dikes.
Oh God!
There'd be great engineering programmes to employ everybody in. It'd be like the New Deal.
I just felt that there's just a certain lack of imagination about how jobs might be, that there was, as unions of the membership of unions has declined, there's a lack of resistance to how work is organised now, and just ideas like universal basic income, this idea that every citizen, no matter what they did, might get an allowance from the state that would free them up to work in a Keynesian way for 3 hours a week, or to pursue hobbies, or for women to have spend more time when they have children, or people just to, you know, learn other languages, or you know, there'd be a space between school and work that helped people understand what they wanted to do. The idea that was proposed by the Green Party but then withdrawn, and so it wasn't even talked about the election, and there's just a lack of imagination about how we would organise society better, I feel. But I hope there are glimmers, and I hope that they continue.
That's a good point for us to finish then. So I've been talking to Joanna Biggs. We've been talking about her book All Day Long, A Portrait of Britain at Work. So Joanna, thank you for coming in and telling me about it.
No, thank you so much.
I'm Jeff Dyer. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Stephen Alcock is a writer, linguist and translator. Born and brought up in Yorkshire, he lived in Berlin for several years before moving to London, where he graduated with an Honours BA in German Language and Literature from Goldsmiths College. In 2013, he was awarded an MA in Contemporary Prose Fiction by Kingston University. And today we're going to be talking about his debut novel, which is Blood Relatives, which was published by Fourth Estate in March of this year. So, Stephen, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're welcome, Neil.
Tell us what the story of Blood Relatives is, first of all.
If I was to do an elevator pitch,
yes.
It's a gay coming-of-age novel set against the era of the Yorkshire Ripper murders. But of course it's a lot more than that.
Yes, so let's expand a little bit more.
Well,
without giving it away.
Yes,
we're not going to talk about the story.
It works on, I hope, on many different levels. But I was exploring the relationship between an emerging gay sexuality and family.
Mm-hmm.
I also have written a book in which a gay working class young man is the narrator
mm-hmm.
and the protagonist, and a young man who's somewhat at ease with his sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to break away from what I saw as there are gay novels in which a gay man is the gay working class man is the central character
mm-hmm.
and the protagonist, but it seemed to me that there was a great untold story of growing up gay in the North as a working class young man. To set it as I did against the background of the Ripper murders, I suppose we'll come to why I did that.
Yeah.
That's the era that I set it in.
And that particular, I mean, the fact that it's in the North, I mean, as you said, a lot of gay fiction about a certain period of time. We're talking about a period where, well, a lot of the men that Ricky, the main character in the book,
yeah.
is meeting to have sex with are from an older generation who lived in a different, you know, in a completely different legal world. Yeah. And it's also, the novel is set between 1975 and 1980.
Yes.
So really in a short period before AIDS and before everything changes in that respect.
It's a real upheaval period.
Mm-hmm.
It's a transition period. It's the period between gay liberation's emergence
mm-hmm.
post-67 and as you say, the era, it concludes a little too neatly, might I say, the Ripper was captured just before the AIDS epidemic
mm-hmm.
in the following decade. So, yes, absolutely.
And then, as I said, it's the North, whereas we would normally expect, as you mentioned, this sort of thing to be set in, you know, in sort of swinging Soho or something.
Yes.
Well, let's just take a step back, first of all. You grew up, you're also, you know, you're from that area and that era, if I may say
yes,
so.
Yes, yes.
So let's talk about what that atmosphere was like in a northern provincial town.
When you're growing up in somewhere, at that age and growing up, everything's new and you haven't got things to compare it
yeah,
against.
I guess it's the only place you know.
And the only place you know,
yeah.
more or less. And everything actually feels really great.
Mm-hmm.
You're finding out who you are, you're pushing forwards in life and you don't know where life is going, but there were new boundaries, new things to explore. So, personally speaking, it was a good time.
So I mean that in itself is reasoning enough to set it in that particular period of time, like you said,
yeah.
that particular period of upheaval.
Yes.
Just so happens, and also at that time the Yorkshire Ripper is on the scene. So let's talk about, well, I guess, I mean, he's a famous person, but let's give us a recap of who he was and what that time was like, because I think it's difficult for people who weren't around at that time to know, first of all, the fear that he cast upon a place. But also, I think, I mean, we'll talk a bit more about this later on when we, Ricky, as part of a sort of persecuted subculture, is also close in the book to another persecuted culture,
yeah.
the sex workers.
Yes.
Who at this period of time, while the Ripper was cutting swathes through them, were basically just, it didn't matter, you know, I mean, they were just disregarded.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, until the murder of Jane McDonald,
mm-hmm.
It was they've got what's coming to them attitude, and also it's happening to prostitutes. Therefore, women who were not prostitutes were, it was in the papers, but it wasn't really anything to do with us. So up to that point, I would say that even the first couple, two or three, the police might have known by number three that they had a serial killer on their hands, but it just was something that came and went in the papers. So it was something that grew, and that was something I had to bring across in the book, that was that fog, that miasma, which is almost gothic, just creeps across the society of the time. And in the mid to later years of his murders, it was it became something that affected everybody. Yeah, you asked me, I've gone ahead of myself a bit here, asking for people who are not aware. I think he had up to 18 victims, including women who survived his attacks. Not all of those feature in the book for a very good reason, and that is that some of the money came apparent after he was confessed, and therefore Rick, the protagonist, Ricky, would not have been aware of it. And some of them were not initially attributed to him, so I kept with the ones that were. His name was Peter Sutcliffe. The press gave him the name of the Yorkshire Ripper. He operated around, I believe he did one attack in Manchester, but the rest of them were in Yorkshire.
So parallel to that narrative is the story of Ricky and his coming of age. Tell us what gay life in Leeds like in the late 1970s.
It was a world beneath the surface of everything that was around. This secret and exciting world, at least that's what I felt it was like. It was obviously, therefore, because it was relatively hidden, quite oppressed.
But at the same time, this is the, you said there's this unique position in time where politically the gay liberation movement
was emerging. Yes, and I used to go to gay liberation front meetings, and there were there's a club, Charlie's Club, is mentioned. I left Leeds in the late 70s, so I don't quite know when it closed down, but it did at some point or other. And I think the New Penny, which is in the book, is still there. But the other Leeds clubs that emerged in the 80s, that hadn't yet emerged. So there was a monthly disco in the Guildford Hotel on the Head Row in Leeds was organised by Gay Liberation Front, and there was CHE, Campaign for Homosexuality Quality as well. So you kind of lean towards going towards those kind of things. And there was a couple of pubs, and that was your lot. And I can remember when that club, the Gemini in Huddersfield, which is long gone. I've mentioned that to a few people and a few other gay men from London. I don't remember that. That was a fantastic place because it was unlike anything else that we'd had before.
And this is, again, also featured in the book, but this is also the era of the National Front. There's racism, there's that sort of common veneer of racism in the book as well, but also those worlds cross over as well, right? The National Front were not
exactly, and I didn't want to have a character in Rick who was going to be one of those struggling to come to terms with his sexuality, ultra PC, dreadful protagonist. I wanted him to have shade and light and try and find his way and make mistakes and fall in love with the wrong people. And then, of course, you have Tad, who he does sort of get obsessed with in that kind of teenage way. And Tad, too, has his issues and problems. He gets mixed up with the National Front for a while.
It's the look. They have a good look.
It's the look, yeah. I toy with that. And of course, it's interesting because I don't know if you read Children of the Sun by Max Schaeffer, which it looks at a piece of fiction, but it looks at set in the year of the gay skinhead movement. It looks at that. And it was interesting. I read that after I'd written my part of TAD and so forth, and the National Front in Leeds and Leeds Bradford, and just it was interesting how much crossover there was. There's what is the word I'm looking for? There's a kind of there's a, unfortunately, a little sort of bit of, you know, adoration of that kind of mm-hmm. look that goes on amongst gay men.
Let's talk about the characters a bit more then. Tell us more about Ricky. So we've sort of described, you know, he's a working class young gay man, but yeah. Tell us a bit more about what he is, what he does.
Yes, I mean, he works on, his job is working for the Corona soft drinks wagons, which older people never remember.
I remember them.
You remember them?
Yeah.
And it was Corona and Alpine. It was a couple
yeah,
of
we used to have Alpine in Leicester.
Right, and they delivered door to door, and that was an easy, I did that job. So that was not as long as he did in the book, but mm-hmm. I did it for a couple of summers and weekends for 2 or 3 years. And so it made sense to give him that job because I could show so much about the landscape. It allowed me to move him around anywhere that I wanted. It was the perfect job for the protagonist to have. Mm-hmm.
It's a very, I mean, obviously that thing doesn't really exist anymore, but it's also a very sort of 70s job.
It is, isn't it?
Confessions of a Window Cleaner type way. It sort of, it gives untold...
I'm not going to be on that level.
No, yeah. But I mean, you know, it sort of, you know, it gives untold opportunities for doorstop
It does, for doorstop. I mean, I suppose Eric is the closest representative mm-hmm. to the window cleaning thing you're ever referring to. But it also, you see, I don't want to go, but inevitably there are parts of my life that are in the book, mm-hmm. inevitably. But the thing about sitting with prostitutes and having tea and mm-hmm. hearing them talking about business, and I mean, that really happened. Mm-hmm. But not in the way that I present it in the book, because I needed to create a narrative. Mm-hmm. We really just sat and drank mugs of tea and they talked about, I don't know, Coronation Street or something, rather than anything or whatever mm-hmm. I put in. But certainly that just meant that I was there when the first prostitutes were talking about the first Ripper murders. So I did mm-hmm. get to hear that as a very young lad, much earlier than a lot of other people would. And mm-hmm. that stayed with me. And when I was writing the book, I thought, I can really use this. And the way that it then brought the world of the sex workers and the world and mm-hmm. his world and what he is together, and so you've got these their life and then his life and then the family life and then and how that initially seems to be like over there, and then mm-hmm. gradually it's pulled together into one narrative by the presence of the Yorkshire Ripper.
I'm Caitlin Doty. Check out the growing Little Adams media empire at littleadams.com.
Listen to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Stephen Olcock and we're talking about his book Blood Relatives. And Stephen, I want to talk a little bit about the writing of the book now. It's your first novel.
Yeah.
You've written it it's basically in a sort of Yorkshire idiom.
Yes.
So let's talk about why you decided to do that and then we can talk about what that was like. I want to talk about the sort of technical side of writing a book in that way as well, but why did you decide to do that first of all?
Well, I wrote the book in the third person without any idiom first time round, and it felt flat. And then I decided to rewrite the whole thing in the first person, and therefore, I was giving it a much stronger voice, and then I started just playing with the idea of putting it in certain, putting certain Yorkshire idioms in there.
But was this still in third person as well before you?
No.
Okay.
No,
so at that point you also made
first
it to the
person,
yeah.
Then I started using the Yorkshire idiom.
Okay, which means it is all going to be
which
rather than just dialogue.
Yes, exactly. That meant I was, you know, and I really ummed and ahed about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, having decided to do it, the question was how far and what.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made certain decisions about the words that I would use. So, you know, he uses war and it's himsen and other words, Caelide and Ginnon and other things which are familiar to Yorkshire people. And and then there was the issue of the guttural T and whether to use that all the time, and then it didn't feel right. So I used it. I set myself certain rules, and out and out and all that kind of thing. And I set myself certain rules, and I stuck to them. And then, only when I'd done that, did I look at what other writers had done.
Mm-hmm.
And I was quite surprised. I then sort of felt, oh my God, I've gone too far. But I ran a few early drafts through past people who were not from Yorkshire, and they went, "Oh yeah, we're fine with it." And so that's how it ended up being, and it just felt alive. It felt much stronger. It felt more colourful, but then I had to be careful that I wasn't falling into some awful cliche.
But how else did it change as well? I mean, if you'd already written the entire book, and then to pull it, first of all, into the first person, but also into this idiom as well, in that second writing process, did it change other aspects of
well,
the book
it did.
As well?
In fact, I would not recommend it doing it this way, but it actually served me really
the
well.
Book twice.
Yes, write the whole book twice. I mean, I was two-thirds of the way through it when I made this decision. There were... In the third person, of course, there were things that happened which he was not present.
Sure.
So you had to then decide what you were going to keep and then restructure it. So it actually served it very well, because then I knew what was happening, if you like, off stage.
Mm-hmm.
And the question was, how much does he know and how am I going to bring that in?
Yeah.
So it actually made it a much more... It made it a much better book, because I was able to introduce conversational elements. There were things that filter through to him by other means.
Yeah.
And I knew sort of what was going on. I knew exactly what was going on, say, in his mother's life. And it was a question of how to put that in and where to put it across, you know. Yes, and also there were a lot of diary entries which I cut out. There was always he was constantly dipping into his sister's diary and things, and they were in the book and they just weren't working. So I cut them out, but I still wanted to have that clandestine thing of reading her diary, that transgressive thing. It was a point of transgression, and so once I got a handle on it, it worked much better.
You're obviously from that area in the first place, although, you know, years ago.
Yeah.
How does one research getting the language correct in that sort of way? How do you go about that?
I didn't. I just went with my instincts. You know, this is how it was. I can do Yorkshire dialect. This is how it was spoken. This is how it was said. And I went with it. And when I was doing the MA, I actually wrote an essay. The use of an essay on dialect and how it was presented, and I was quite surprised actually how far I'd gone. And if I looked at what Kestrel, the renowned Barry Hines novel, is written in the third person, so he steps in and out of it.
Yeah,
and others I found, like John Brain, there wasn't any Yorkshire dialect at all. I struggled to find anything that went, you know. I looked at Ross Raisin and it was God's Own Country. He'd done some and even provided a little glossary. it was so I thought, oh, I've gone too far here. And in the end, people didn't, readers didn't think so.
I was going to say about the MA, because I couldn't tell from the title to what extent there was a creative writing element to it, or whether you were just, you know, studying contemporary prose fiction as it's described. So I wanted to talk about how that helped. I mean, how do you think doing that
helps with it? Two things. I mean, I was writing before that. I mean, I've been writing for years and years. I was writing in a kind of splendid isolation, together with my ex, who was also now a published writer. And the two of us were writing while we were living together for about 10 years. And we didn't have any other context as to where we were, how good we were. And the other reason for doing the MA was to open doors. I achieved exactly that. It did what it did. And it made it a much better book because I had all the professional writers who were my tutors and my fellow students feeding into giving me feedback on what I'd done and what I was doing. So, yes, it made it a better book, and it got me through to my agent, and then, of course, from the agent, everything else was history. So, it might still be sitting in a slush pile at the moment.
As you said at the beginning, it's unusual in that it's a coming-of-age story about a gay man in a northern town.
Yeah.
But the setting and that era has become quite familiar to literature, to people like David Peace and stuff.
Yeah.
And that whole, you know, the thematics of the Red Riding trilogy, of the sort of the Ripper, and then obviously a later era than this, but, you know, the Hillsborough, and now just this whole new Bradford Fire thing has just come out. I mean, right up to the present day with, like, the sort of, you know, Rotherham, and the whole, that area seems ripe for these stories of police corruption and just general corruption. And of course, the whole patron saint of that whole thing now pops up in this book, Jimmy Savile, at some
he
point.
He does. And one reviewer said, you know, oh, even rather unkindly, well, even Jimmy Savile is been tuned into this or whatever. I can't remember what that really was. And sort of the implication that now that Jimmy Savile affair had come out into the open, I'd stop that in. But actually, it's already written that.
He was integral to all of that.
He was a presence in Leeds. How could I not?
Famous photograph of him shaking hands with Peter Sutcliffe as well. right, just one last question. It does say in the blurb at this book that you're working on your next novel.
Oh,
so tell us something
about
what's
next.
So what's next? What can you tell us about it?
Oh,
I mean, not much.
No.
No, nothing at all.
No, nothing at all.
Okay.
I've always found it really difficult to talk about whatever you're working on.
How far progressed is it?
Well, it depends which draft you read.
How many times are you going to write this one?
a lot less. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say how far I am in it, but I've written a considerable amount. And I wrote another novel before this one, which has never seen the light of day, and quite a few short stories and things. So there are things which I can use and recycle. It will not be a follow-up to this.
No.
I think I have to take a big risk and write something completely different. But that's really all I can say.
Well, this has been out since March now, so a couple of months. So now, being a published writer, having that first novel out there in the world, how does that change what comes next, really? Do you know what I mean? Does that change your perspective?
Well, it gives you difficult second album syndrome for a while. And then it does change your perspective. It gives you a validity to what you're doing. It gives yourself a validity. Mm-hmm. You're allowed to do it now.
You're a novelist.
You're a novelist, official, you know. And they can never take that one away, the first blood relative. So it does change everything. Whereas before you become a published novelist, you think, what right have I to think along with half the planet that I am going to write a novel, and this is going to happen and that's going to happen? Although that's disingenuous, because I kind of got a sense that it was pretty good, but I didn't know how good, and I still really kind of like, you think it's that good, you know, if people do, and it kind of, I'm quite humbled by it, to be honest. I certainly don't want to get ahead of myself or anything like that, and just get on with doing the next book, and that's what I concentrate on.
I've been talking to Stephen Alcock. We've been talking about his book Blood Relatives, which is out now from Fourth Estate. So, Stephen, thank you very much for taking the time to tell me about it.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
The show is supported by 89UP and hosted by Positive Internet. You can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
You can find old interviews, new journalism, and more on our relaunched website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.